All right, everybody, it's approaching the top of the hour here. So I am going to get us started as the recording has started with some housekeeping for today. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clumin for those not able to join us live. The Clumin training page that brought you here today also offers the training materials like the slides and trainer information available for your perusal at your own pace. We ask that you please use the Q&A box to ask any questions, make comments, or report any technical problems that you encounter during today's training. This training does incorporate the chat box for some interactive portions, whereas the chat box will be used for those portions. Again, please put your any questions or technical issues in the Q&A pod, as that's where we will be looking for those relevant information. We're going to have two Q&A breaks, one in the middle and the last one at the end of the training modules today. For those interested in certificates of completion, they will be available at the end of the training by completing the feedback form. Once you complete the form and certify that you participated, a certificate will be emailed to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, the federal government, private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to become a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website where you can find out more about the active teams and more about how to become a member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty any material nor endorse any specific products. At this point, I am going to turn it over to Valerie Hanley, one of the microplastic team leaders, to get us started on our training today.
Thank you so much, Devin. Yes, my name is Dr. Valerie Hanley. I am a senior toxicologist with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I have had the honor of leading this team for the past 3.5 years through its various forms. And we are very excited right now to present to you our training on our ITRC Microplastics Technical Guidance document. We've got an excellent group of trainers today, and you will be hearing from all of them as we move through. Their contact information is available on the screen and through CLUIN if you'd like to contact any of them for some additional information. This is a training roadmap that you will see multiple times throughout the morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. We will have an introduction to microplastics led by Dietschle. We have an interactive case study that we will use throughout here that Alex McDonald will introduce and walk us through. And that's that chat function that Devin mentioned earlier. We'll use that chat for those interactive case studies. We have a section on environmental distribution, fate, and transport that Judd will take us through. And then Aaliyah will introduce us to sampling and analysis and specific considerations for microplastics. We'll then have our first Q&A session. So again, use that Q&A pod to ask questions, or you can, and we will answer those live during that time. And then I will go over the human health and ecological effects section. And then Alex will also take, I'm sorry, Nizana will take on the regulatory context and give it a little bit more information about what laws are out there right now related to microplastics. Yasmin will take us through mitigation and abatement. And then I will go through, I'm sorry, I keep trying to take credit. I have done different portions of this training at different times. Todd will take us through the wrap-up slides. And then finally, we will have our final Q&A session. So before we jump into it, I want us to test out that chat function. And I would just love everyone to put one thing that you think you know about microplastics in that chat just to get us going so we can kind of get an idea of where our audience members are. I see forever, it accumulates, they are everywhere, everywhere, pervasive, they exist, they're everywhere, ubiquitous, in my body, everywhere. Yes. Excellent biofilm, so many sizes in clouds in Lake Tahoe, more than you think. All excellent responses that I'm seeing coming in. Yeah, I think that it looks like people are very much on the same page and have a general understanding of microplastics. And we hope we'll give you a lot more information in the coming training. And so, with that, I will hand it over to Dietschli Yardnichi with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control to give you an introduction to microplastics. Dietschli?
Thank you, Ellery. So I'm just waiting for. Hello, everyone. I'm Dietschli Yardımcı. I'm a senior engineer with the Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I will be presenting you the introduction section of our training today. And in this training, our overarching goal is to provide you an understanding of microplastics and the state of applied science without having to go to the scientific literature. And with that, I will start with the history of plastic. The first synthetic plastic was invented dating all the way back to early 1900s. And then there was a variety of plastics invented from 1930s to 1945. But the biggest growth of the plastic industry occurred in 1950s. And when you look at the plot on the left-hand side here, you could see that with the growth in the plastic industry, that also caused a large increase in the plastic waste being accumulated in the environment. And if we continue to do the business, you see the black dotted line here. That will be the plastic waste continue to accumulate in the environment in the next coming years. And because of the plastic waste problem, there were some bio-based and biodegradable plastics were invented from 1970s and beyond. However, those weren't very good inventions in terms of reducing the plastic pollution, which we will talk about later in this training. And this data belongs to 2010. It shows that when there was 270 million tons of plastic was globally produced, within that same time frame, there was 275 million tons of plastic waste was accumulated in the environment. Notice that the plastic waste is actually higher than the plastic production. That's because once the plastic is produced, it starts to accumulate as waste in the environment from previous years. And 99 million tons of that plastic ends up as waste in the coastal areas, and 31 million of that is mismanaged, which puts about 8 million tons of plastic waste into the oceans every year. And tens and 100,000 tons of that plastic ends up in surface waters. And in 2020, the plastic production increased to 500 million tons. That data is not shown here, which is almost the plastic production is almost doubled in size within a decade. So we expect plastic waste to continue to increase in the environment. And today's training topic, we are going to talk about microplastics. So microplastics are tiny plastic particles. They are ubiquitous in the environment. They are found in surface waters, drinking water, in the air, and even the food that humans consume. They can accumulate and persist long time in the environment. They can also move long distances in the throughout different environmental media, including air, water, and soil. They can contain harmful chemical contaminants and additives. They can also move those contaminants with them as they move throughout the environment. And because of their small size, they can be consumed by humans and other organisms, and they can cause adverse health impacts on the humans and organisms that are exposed to microplastics. So one thing to note here, there is no universally accepted definition of microplastics. However, it's generally there's a consensus that microplastics are particles that are less than 5 millimeter in size. So ITRC's microplastics team reviewed all the existing definitions of microplastics in the world, and in our guidance document, we have defined microplastics as particles that are greater than 1 nanometer and less than 5 millimeter in their longest dimension, that are comprised of solid polymeric materials to which chemical additives and other substances may have been added. Polymers that are derived in nature that have not been chemically modified other than hydrolysis are excluded from this definition. And as a context, polymers are made of building blocks called monomers, and hydrolysis is a reaction that breaks down polymers into their monomers using water. And ITRC's microplastics team defined the microplastic size ranging from 1 nanometer up to 5 millimeters. And this is a figure that shows you different materials to compare to the microplastic size. This is available in the chapter one of our guidance document. So microplastics can be, the sizes can be up to 5 millimeters, which is about the size of a drinking straw. And they can be as small as 1 nanometer, which is smaller even than a strand of a DNA. And in addition to size, microplastics come in a variety of physical chemical properties, such as they can be made of different polymers. They can also have different additives. They can also come from different sources, depending on the product type, which we will talk about shortly. They can come in different colors, different shapes. And depending on the size, shape, and color, some organisms may confuse them with food and selectively feed on them. So that can affect the toxicity endpoints. They can also attract different toxicants, such as heavy metals, PFASs, and others. So they're very complex. And going back to that microplastic sources, they can come from different product types. And generally, they are classified either primary or secondary microplastics, which we will talk about in a minute. I would like to point out this is a visual that is available in chapter two of our guidance document. It shows you different product types as sources of microplastics. And primary microplastics are the ones that are intentionally manufactured as microplastics for specific products or applications. And in the figure here, you can see that microbeads in personal care products, it shows a toothpaste with microbeads in them, is considered primary microplastics. And pre-production pellets, also known as nurdles, are also primary microplastics. Nurdles are building blocks of a variety of plastic products manufacturing. And in this training, I would like to point out that we will be using scientific terms, and you can find the definitions of those terms in the glossary section of our guidance document. So this is a case study that shows citizens picking up nurdles along the Gulf of Mexico. And nurdles, as we mentioned, they are an example of primary microplastics. And this case study highlights the importance of citizen science to drive litigation and to impact policy. And the details of this case study can be found in the appendix section of our guidance document. Secondary microplastics are the ones that originate from larger plastics that fragment into smaller pieces due to being exposed to environmental conditions such as UV light, wind, or water erosion. And some examples of the secondary microplastics include wear and tear of car tires, fragmentation of water bottles, cigarette butts, or microfibers shedding from textiles. And this is another case study that shows that there was an increase in the amount of the disposable PPEs and single-use plastic items in the environment, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. And these items will eventually fragment into smaller pieces to form microplastics, and this will be an example of secondary microplastics. And again, the details of this case study can also be found in our guidance document in the appendix section. As we mentioned, in addition to size and different product sources, microplastics can also come in different shapes. So this figure shows you different shapes of microplastics. They can also come in different colors. These shapes include beads, fragments, sheets, filament, fibers, foams. Depending, as we mentioned, depending on the shape, size, and color of these microplastics, some of the organisms think confuse these microplastics with food sources, and they actually selectively feed on them. And depending on the size and shape, they can interact differently with the tissues of the organisms. They can translocate between tissues, so that will affect the toxicity endpoints. And some studies have shown that for microplastics that are made of from the same polymer type and same size, the rougher shapes, such as fragments, will have higher chemical adsorption capacity compared to the regular shapes, such as beads, because of the increased surface area to volume ratio. And microplastics can adsorb harmful chemicals, such as heavy metals or persistent organic pollutants, also known as PAPs. Some examples of PAPs include PCBs, PFASs, and others. And there are several factors that can enhance the chemical adsorption capacity of microplastics. Microplastics are hydrophobic, which means they repel water and they attract these chemicals onto themselves from the water bodies. And they can also carry those chemicals with them as they move throughout aquatic environments. As we talked about, they have small size, which means they have high surface area to volume ratio to adsorb chemicals. And rougher shapes, as well as weathered and aged particles, also have rougher shapes, will have higher chemical adsorption capacity compared to the regular shapes that are made from same polymer type and same size. And also, polymer type the microplastic is made of also can affect the chemical adsorption capacity. Low density and rubbery plastics, such as polyethylene or polypropylene, will have higher chemical adsorption capacity compared to microplastics made of high density or glossy plastics, such as PET or PVC. Microplastics can also act as vectors, so they can allow formation of biofilms, which then be a vector for carrying bacterial pathogens. They can also spread antibiotic resistant bacteria. And microplastics can move long distances in the environment and carry chemical contaminants throughout water, air, soil, sediment. Therefore, they can be a source of contaminants in the aquatic environment, sediments, and biota. However, vector effects of microplastics is not well understood. Therefore, there are additional studies needed to understand the vector effects of microplastics. And to summarize, microplastics are emerging contaminants of concern, and the state of science is rapidly evolving. As you can see on the plot here, it shows you, especially after 2015, there has been an increase in the number of microplastics toxicity studies, both including human health, that's shown in the orange bars, and also ecological, shown in the black bars here. So microplastics do contribute to the plastic pollution. And because of their small size, they can be consumed by humans and organisms. And again, depending on their physical chemical properties, they can have variety of toxicity endpoints. Because of their variety of physical chemical properties, it makes them very complex to understand their toxicity endpoints. So there is always more studies needed to understand them better. And with that concludes our introduction section of our training today. And now I'm going to turn it over to Alex McDonald, and he will introduce an interactive case study, which we will use throughout this training. Thank you for your attention, Alex. I think
Hey,
there's
Alex, can you hear us?
Delay.
Sorry about that. Excuse
No
me.
worries.
Hi. I'm Alex McDonald. I'm retired, currently retired, but previously I was a senior engineer for the California Regional Water Quality Control Board in Sacramento. I am here to give you the interactive case study, which is going to do in three parts. And let me get you the first slide here. It's not working. There it goes. Okay, so what we're gonna do, I'm gonna give you a hypothetical environment. So if you look at the slide here on the left-hand side, you see a cartoon, and this is basically a bay. Think San Francisco Bay, Chesapeake Bay, Puget Sound, something like that. And around this bay, we have man's activities. You know, we have humans doing the things that humans do. We have residential area. We have a factory. We have a landfill. Roadways, a beach, and beaches to give you an idea. Okay, this is man's activities outdoors. What is he doing outdoors that might have something to do with microplastics? There's fishing. There's critters everywhere. They're aquatic critters. There's airborne critters. There's land critters, and there's a farm. And so, what we're going to do here is we're going to go through this in the next two times you get to see me. Is we're going to go through going to identify sources, pathways, and receptors. And so this is where you get to participate. You get, you know, get off your hands and use your mouse to give me the answers to the question I'm going to pose to you. So you're going to put your answers in the chat when we do this, and you'll have 30 seconds to do this in. So I haven't clicked to the next screen yet because every time I've done this previously, people start answering before I start talking. So the first one we're going to do is we're going to go come up here, and we're going to go to say, okay, identify the microplastic sources that you see here. So you have use the chat function, put your answers directly into the chat function. And I see, we got tires, we got road. Okay, people have the answers. Slay should have given you some information, and we haven't given you all the answers. Tires, roadways, seed coatings, fertilizer, fishing, very good. Beaches, runoff, trash, landfill, fishing nets, fertilizer. Looks like you guys are getting most of them. We got 8 more seconds left of our 30 seconds. You guys are doing a great job without even having gotten to these yet. Todd's going to be giving us some answers to that pretty soon. Okay, we can stop now. Very good. So let me give you the answer to the next one. Okay, possible MP sources. I think you got most of these. Roadways are made, sometimes they're actually made with a high percentage of plastic in the asphalt materials. Wastewater treatment plant, it doesn't make plastics, but it passed through for plastics coming through the system. Farming, biosolids put on the farm from the wastewater treatment plant, you see. Housing, residential, everyday residential uses of plastic materials. The fishing boat, as someone said, they have the fishing nets, most of them are made of plastic nowadays. The landfill itself receives plastic and stuff blows out of that landfill. Car tires and then beach use, which is it can be just man's activities outdoors. You guys did a great job. And so with that, I'm gonna turn you over to Judd. He's from Tetra Tech, and he's gonna be talking about environmental fate and transport. And take it away, Judd.
Thanks, Alex. Let me see if I've got control of the slides here. All right, I believe I do now. Okay, so hi, everyone. As Alex said, I'm Judd Mahan. I'm with the consulting firm Tetra Tech, and we're going to walk through environmental distribution, fate, and transport of microplastics right now. The slide here, this is the conceptual site model that's used in the online guidance document. On the website, it's an interactive figure, so it'll have pop-ups with information about various sources and mechanisms of microplastic transport. In this set of slides, we'll use the CSM as we talk through some examples, and you can also use the interactive CSM to navigate through the online document. Okay, so we'll start with point sources. Here we have some examples of point sources of microplastics. Point sources are discrete conveyances, such as stormwater or wastewater outfalls, smokestacks. Also, there can be marine point sources, such as ocean-going vessels that might have materials lost overboard or simply discarded. And then to non-point sources, due to the ubiquitous nature of microplastics, non-point sources are especially problematic. This is where you might have broad areas or many sources at once that are distributing microplastics into the environment. Beaches are an example where litter may be spread along a beach and then it washes or it could be transported by wind into other areas. Excuse me. Residential neighborhoods can also be non-point sources where household products are used and discarded. Agricultural lands, another example, microplastics may originate from fertilizer pellets or wastewater treatment plant biosolids that could be used as soil amendments. And then even home gardening materials such as plastic, sheeting, containers, gloves, things like this are sources of microplastics. And then roadways here, another non-point source as tires are worn down and generate tire wear particles. This is a case study. I just mentioned the tire wear particles. This is a case study that's used in the online guidance document. Tire wear particles are, again, generated by that friction between the tire and the road surface. The particles are then deposited nearby in surface waters, soil. 6-PPD is an anti-ozonant. It's used in the manufacture of car tires. And 6-PPD quinone is a degradation byproduct, which has been linked to coho salmon mortalities. Research is ongoing to understand why coho salmon are so susceptible to the effects of 6-PPD, as well as to understand whether other aquatic organisms might be affected. There's more information on this case study in the online guidance document. Now, we just talked about tire wear being, you know, one source, one way that that microplastics are generated. Microplastics are generated in a variety of ways. There are both abiotic and biotic processes that are involved, including chemical, physical, biological reactions. Size distribution is an important factor in fate and transport of microplastics, with processes such as biofouling, aggregation, time of residence. All of this affects the fate and transport and hence the overall environmental distribution. Photodegradation, that's an important process, initial degradation process at the Earth's surface, but biodegradation becomes important in no-light zones, such as in soils. Now, we're going to move into some different environmental compartments. First, with the fluvial environment here, streams and rivers play an important role with microplastics distribution. Physical properties determine how particles are transported, whether that's more quickly, more slowly. Heavier particles are going to be more likely to sink and are to be deposited in sinks, such as lakes and other areas of decreased flow velocity. Two-way transport, that's a significant factor to keep in mind. Microplastics can move from land to water to air and potentially cycle back through these media. We'll move to surface water now or freshwater systems, which receive microplastics from a variety of sources, including atmospheric deposition, groundwater infiltration, stormwater discharges, wastewater discharges. Rivers, again, important transport corridors, and they move microplastics from upland areas to bays and estuaries, which are home to, you know, many organisms that are used as food sources, mussels, crustaceans, other deposit feeders that can ingest microplastics. One concern that arises here is that microplastics can alter nutrient cycling and might contribute to an increase in ammonium, which triggers red tides. Wastewater treatment plants, industrial and municipal, are one of the primary sources contributing microplastics to surface water. And we'll talk a little bit more about wastewater on this next slide here. So microplastics from wastewater, they're sourced from industrial and domestic products. Now, products, vary greatly, and microplastics are generated both during the manufacture and during the use of products. Treatment plant processes, have been shown to successfully remove microplastics. However, there's a lack of standard treatments and analysis methods, and this limits the overall efficiency of microplastics removal in wastewater plants. Many treatment plants process biosolids for land application, which can lead to a re-release of plastics to the environment. Studies show that microplastics sourced from wastewater treatment plants, they tend to occur as fibers and be of a relatively smaller size fraction, generally less than half of a millimeter. Now, groundwater, this can be a surprise, but there's limited data on the occurrence of microplastics in groundwater right now, but the data that is available does show that microplastics are occurring in this environmental compartment, although at a lower prevalence than in other types of water. Most environmental monitoring wells are constructed of plastic, generally PVC, which creates obstacles to sampling and analysis. Again, the movement is going to be affected by particle size and density, but other factors are also important, such as pH, salinity. And then, as with many environmental contaminants, preferential pathways are something to think about here, as they can aid transport. Some studies have shown microplastics occurring in groundwater, including locations from Illinois in the United States, as well as Germany, South Africa. As research continues, the geographic locations that are reporting microplastics are likely to increase. And then the oceans, plastic pollution in oceans, this really gets a lot of attention in public media, and there's a lot of information that's available on this. This slide touches on some of the concepts that are involved. Microplastics are entering oceans by multiple routes, such as rivers, outfalls, as well as the atmosphere. They tend to move at the ocean surface towards slower-moving oceanic gyres. The denser plastics will tend to sink, and they're reported from all depths. Floating debris is moved by various mechanisms. Some of these are ocean currents and convergence zones, as well as Stokes drift, which has to do with transport by wave action, and Langmuir circulation, which has to do with wind interacting with the ocean surface. As we mentioned, with fluvial environments, vertical transport factors include degradation, aggregation, biofouling, as well as the varying buoyancy of different plastic materials. And to soils now, which are likely to be long-term sinks for microplastics, and that's because most plastic is used on land. Higher abundances are observed near roads and areas where plastic is used or processed. This can include waste management facilities, agricultural areas. We mentioned home gardens. Plastics have a potential to alter soil properties, such as by changing the bulk density and the water retention capacity. Research is showing that fibers, plastic fibers, have distinctly negative effects compared to other forms of plastic. And sediment, we've talked about sediment being a plastic, microplastics being deposited in sediments as they settle from the water column. This happens in marine and freshwater, both flowing and non-flowing systems. As we've touched on, denser plastics are going to tend to sink and be deposited. Research indicates that sediments that are higher in total organic carbon also tend to contain more microplastics. Residence time in sediments can be high, especially in low flow conditions. And again, that resuspension and redistribution are factors to be aware of. And the atmosphere or the air, again, this, like groundwater, it could be a surprise. It's more common in urban and industrialized areas. Deposition can then occur with precipitation events. It turns out that microplastics are an emerging component of air pollution, and plastics can combine with other air pollutants. Transport varies with atmospheric factors, such as wind speed and then up or down drafts. No surprise here, the atmospheric occurrence, it tends to be those smaller microplastic fractions, but includes various shapes. We'll talk a little bit about urban litter here, or litter in general. So larger plastic breaks down into microplastics, and it turns out that the plastic portion of litter can vary dramatically. A study in the San Francisco Bay Area showed that 2 to 15% of litter by volume was plastic, whereas a study from the Mississippi River Basin showed that plastic was making up up to 74% of litter. Either way, storm events play a big role in the transport of litter. A study in Los Angeles indicated that microplastics concentrations increased by sevenfold at the coast near Long Beach after a storm. Similarly, a Great Lakes study showed that all forms of microplastics, from films to pellets, increased in concentration as a result of precipitation events. Now, to the biosphere or biota, the occurrence of microplastics in living organisms, that's something else that's getting a lot of attention in public media nowadays. From plants to invertebrates and mammals, it spans all levels of the food web. Research is clearly showing that microplastics are being ingested. More studies are needed to determine the effects of this. With plants, studies show uptake by crops through roots, with transport then to shoots and fruits such as tomatoes. Some organisms are particularly vulnerable. Filter feeders, for instance, are at risk due to their suspension feeding mechanism on particulate matter. And then other marine life, such as fish and macroinvertebrates, are also ingesting microplastics. So that's it for an overview of the distribution, the fate, and transport. There's a lot more detail, as well as some really good references that are available in the online guidance document. And now I'm going to hand it back over to Alex and the interactive case study.
Thanks, Judd. Let me see here. All right. So we're going to go to part two now. If you listen to Judd, you should be able to excel at this. The next questions we're going to ask you. He gave a whole bunch of good information, and our goal is to help reinforce that information and have you do this quiz for us. So let me see here. Next one. Where is it going? Okay. So first question is going to ask, before we ask the question, what are the sources? You identified those very well. So now we're going to say, what media is being impacted by those sources? You don't really see media per se here. I mean, you do subtly, but not in these cartoony pictures. So you're going to have to use your thought process. Come up with in the chat here, 30 seconds, and identify what media is impacted by the sources we identified. Air, groundwater, flora, everything, water, biota, streams and oceans, surface water. You guys are getting them all. Organisms, air, water. So think of it as a media. Sometimes organisms might not be called a media. So someone just said all media, which is true. Muscles. Okay, very good. Now you can put a halt to that, and so you can answer that question. Where do they answer that question? So the things that are impacted air, ambient air. We're putting out microplastics from the factories, from just everyday use, is being picked up by the wind, from the ground surface, from erosion, from the roadways, from the tire wear, all being picked up and put into the air. In fact, that's our basic exposure, is through ambient air. Surface and subsurface soils, you know, we put things on the ground, stuff leaches in the ground, migrates through by infiltration of rainfall or others, are basically leaching through the riverbanks and that sort of thing. Groundwater, which is kind of an unusual one. Groundwater, yes, Judd described. There are some case studies showing that we do have groundwater impacts by plastics in certain areas, particularly around landfills, Biosolids application areas, beach sand, we're using the beach sand, the beach that's sitting up there, crops and produce. I don't remember anyone, they probably had crops and produce, but that would be another media that's impacted by by our activities. Very good job. So we're going to have another question here this time. This time, so we've done sources, what media are impacted by the sources, and now we're going to look at how from the sources to that media, how is it transported? So we're going to look at transportation mechanisms that were occurred. So we're going to look at the same process, go to the chat function, put down your answers. We have 30 seconds. So how did these media get impacted? How is it transported around within that media? Runoff, we got wind and rain, precipitation, food currents, waves, wind, air, humidity, urban runoff, leaching and erosion. Very good. Getting them all, animals themselves. Sure, you can actually pick animals are going to pick up and eat it and deposit it somewhere else. Wave action. Very good. Okay, you've got 5 more seconds and then you can stop. You guys, I think you got most of the answers here. So here's going to be the answer for that. So transportation pathways. I have red arrows indicating pathways. So basically, rainfall events from clouds, rainfall events driving into the ground and migrating it via creeks and rivers to the ocean, to the bay. Rainfall itself, stormwater discharge, as the things are deposited on the ground and run and erosion occurs, then the stormwater is going to pick up that those plastics have been placed on the ground and deposited them downstream somewhere. Factory stack emissions, you'll see that. Windblown materials from from the landfill. In fact, the landfill can actually leach into groundwater. Wastewater discharge and agricultural soil disturbance. Not only just the soil disturbance, over irrigation, excess irrigation water can pick up microplastics from the biosolids that have been placed there and move those off property. And then we had over here the transport pathways erosion or basic abrasion from plastics on a fishing boat net. So that gives you, so you guys did a great job listening. Continue listening. We're going to check in on a little bit later. And now I'm going to turn you over to Aaliyah from TRC. She's going to be discussing sampling and analysis.
Thank you, Alex. All right. This first slide here is a summary of what we'll cover during this section of sampling and analysis. We'll talk about considerations for selecting appropriate methods. We will go through the ITRC tools that we've developed to help you choose those appropriate methods. We have one for sampling and one for analysis. I will cover the standard or adopted methods that are available for microplastics for both of these. And we will go through minimizing sample contamination. So here we return back to our conceptual site model, this time with sampling and analysis in mind. You can see the red dots here. If you click on the various dots, you will get little call-out boxes with each of the different media associated with that dot. And those call-out boxes will link you to different sections within the guidance document, one for sample collection and one for sample preparation or analysis. So before we go into the tools that we've developed in this guidance document, we'll talk about what is important to do before you use those tools, and that is thinking about your data quality objectives. Some important considerations are shown here. Oops. Things like sample media, particle size, minimum detectable amount, and data needed. Things like, do you need to know about the size, shape, polymer, or unit of the microplastics, and then what equipment and costs you have available. And this is a very important step because the data you will be able to obtain from different sampling and analysis methods is it varies. For example, certain sampling methods are limited to obtaining results down to a certain size range. And similarly, certain analytical methods may not be able to provide information on polymer types or shapes. Now we move into the tools that we've developed for this guidance document. The first is one for sample collection. We have a little video here showing you how you can use that tool. It is an online matrix that can be filtered using two criteria, matrix and particle size, as you can see here. In this example, we select wastewater for the matrix or media, and we select all size fractions for the size ranges. The tool then filters to provide the methods that fit these two criteria, and you can change the parameters to get different results. So the table also provides additional details, including as we scroll down, you can see details on the sample collection method, a description of the method, what equipment is needed, advantages and disadvantages, relative cost, and there are also some literature references if you want more information. The methods shown in that online matrix tool are methods described in the literature. Due to the evolving nature of our understanding of microplastics, there are very few standardized methods available. However, there are a few for water media. You can see those here. The first is an ASTM standard for a variety of water types, drinking water, surface water, wastewater, and marine waters. And the second is a California Water Board's method specific to drinking water. Both of these methods use a similar concept, which is volumetric reduction, which is using a series of sieves to filter a large volume of water to get a more representative sample result than a simple grab sample. Though a second method listed here is slightly different from the first in that it uses inline sieve filtration. And what that does is it minimizes the potential for ambient air contamination during sampling. To select the appropriate analytical procedure to characterize your microplastic samples, we have developed Table 3.1. An excerpt of that is shown here. This, similar to the sampling matrix, it provides capabilities and details for a variety of methods for analyzing microplastics to help you determine which method is most appropriate for your project or site. And as you can see here, similar to the sampling table, it provides a description as well as different criteria such as size detection limits and if it detects particles or mass and a lot of other criteria that aren't shown in this small excerpt of the table. Similar to sampling methods, there are a few methods that California has adopted specifically for drinking water samples. As shown here, these include FTIR and Raman methods. As we heard in all the previous sections, plastics are used for innumerable products in our modern world. Because of this, it is very important to both minimize contamination and account for the contamination or potential sample contamination throughout the process of sampling and analysis. So at a high level, to minimize contamination, you should eliminate plastic products used in your sampling and analysis processes to the extent practicable, and also set up a clean laboratory. To account for contamination, you should collect various blanks to quantify potential contamination because we can't expect to totally eliminate contamination of microplastics. This figure 3.2 from the guidance document shows some of the considerations that a commercial laboratory implemented to create their clean lab for their microplastic sampling program or analyzing program. These include things like aluminum ceiling tiles, a dedicated custom designed gowning room with airlock that has separate HVAC systems with HEPA filters that trigger positive pressure when the technician moves from the exterior hallway to the gowning room and then into the clean room. They have a very rigorous water filtration system and they conduct twice daily cleaning with a HEPA filtered vacuum. So in conclusion, sampling and analysis methods for microplastics are evolving and being evaluated. There are two standard sampling methods for water, and California has adopted two analytical methods for drinking water. However, aside from these specific media and scenarios that we've discussed, we encourage you to use our tools in the guidance document to identify which methods are most appropriate for sampling and analysis of microplastics for your project or site. And while you're investigating microplastics, make sure to minimize and account for contamination due to plastic's ubiquitous nature. Now we'll pause the content to take a quick question and answer break.
All right, thank you so much, Aaliyah. I'm going to just quickly take back remote control here so we don't advance slides unnecessarily. Like Aaliyah said, we are going to look now to our Q&A pod for questions for our trainers to answer live. So just to be conscious of time, I'm going to jump right into the questions there. Our first one, is it dangerous to reuse water bottles or dangerous to use plastic food storage containers?
Hi, Devin, I can take that. So I guess the first thing I would say is our upcoming section is on human health effects, and dangerous is kind of an interesting term, right? In terms of reusing water bottles, you do see increased microplastics going into water. I mean, from water, using water bottles in general, especially if those get heated up. Microwaving plastic food storage containers has certainly been shown to increase microplastics release into items that are heated in those containers. That said, there is still a lot to learn about the health effects related to microplastics, and we'll talk about that in the next session.
Wonderful. Thank you, Val. All right, next question. Are there any economically viable technologies for testing microplastics in soils for agriculture use?
Hi. I would refer you to look at our analytical methods table to see what methods are listed there and see what would be useful for you there. We don't, as we've mentioned, there aren't really standardized methods for soil. And so it depends on what kind of data specifically you're looking for.
All right. Thank you, Aaliyah. Next question. How does using POU water filtration systems affect, perhaps increase, microplastic values?
I will say I am not familiar with the POU water filtration. I don't know if anyone else on the team is, but unfortunately, I don't feel like I can answer that question appropriately.
I think they're talking point of use water filtration systems, similar to the things that under your, you know, your tap in your house or your refrigerator has a filter system in it.
Yeah.
It all depends on what the filter material is made of. In other words, if it's using activated carbon or it's using some sort of polymer or something else of that nature. If it's using carbon, probably doesn't increase plastic concentrations. It probably actually remove some. I'm not sure about shedding from various polymers into the system. I have not read any studies on that.
All right, thank you, trainers. I will remind our attendees to please put your questions in the Q&A pod. A few have come in through the chat, and I'll read the ones that were there. But moving forward, Q&A pod is where we will be looking for those questions specifically. All right, our next question. How do you account for the microplastics generated in the lab when using things like pipettes to avoid false data reporting?
That goes back to the blanks. I would recommend getting some clean water and doing some blanks, like equipment blanks, with your pipettes. And you can especially, you know, if you can find out information about the products you're using that you can't eliminate that are plastics and know what types of polymers they consist of, that could be useful information to determine if the blank is, or if the detection is coming from your equipment or if it's from another source.
All right. Thank you, Aaliyah. Our next question, are there guidelines that touch on what the researcher wears? My lab has specifically has dyed cotton lab coats that we use to match HITs. I wanted to see how ubiquitous this was.
I'm not aware of any standard, but I have seen that type of suggestion in different literature as well. So I think that is a good method.
Thank you, Leah. Next question. Any recommendations on PPE for sampling slash analysis, for example, glove material?
Obviously, worker safety is very important, so you don't want to skimp to avoid microplastics. So, yeah, similar to the others, if you know what the materials are that you're using that you can't eliminate from your process, if you know the polymer type that or color, that can be useful information. And yeah, just taking wash samples or equipment type blank samples is an option if you're concerned about that potentially contaminating your samples.
And in the field blanks.
All right, thank you, trainers. Next question. Are certain plastic types more prone to physical degradation? For example, comparing polyethylene versus polypropylene versus polyvinyl chloride.
Well, I would say all of them do create microplastics. So we do know that plastics that are more brittle and hard do tend to break more easily. And so they can form microplastics, I think, more quickly. I don't know that I have specific data on, comparing rates for all of those different ones, but I do know that they all do contribute to microplastics.
Thank you, Val. How does the type of plastic impact the concentration of microplastic contamination? For example, LDPE versus HDPE, etc.
I think that's very similar to the last question. So they all do create microplastics eventually as they break down. It might just happen to affect how quickly they break down. Interestingly, we think of bioplastics are used a lot, and sometimes we think of that as being a more appropriate or you're using less plastic and it's a safer alternative. But oftentimes those bioplastics just degrade quicker into microplastics. And then the effects of those microplastics are indistinguishable from traditional petroleum-based plastics. So, it's not necessarily, it's a good thing from a visual standpoint and what we see in terms of things breaking down more quickly in terms of biodegradation, but it's hard to know exactly what happens with those microplastics. And only under very ideal conditions will they break down entirely. So that's something to keep in mind as you're choosing plastics.
Thanks so much, Val.
I would like to add something regarding LDPE versus HDPE. If you are concerned with PFAS, it is better to focus on HDPE to use for the procedures that whatever you are doing, sampling or analyzing purposes. I just want to mention that.
All right, thank you, trainers. We have time for one last question, and then we will go back to our training modules. And again, we will end with another Q&A session at the end. So feel free to continue putting questions in, and we will either respond via typing a response or answer them live at the end of the modules today. So our last question for this Q&A session here. Landfills were identified as a source of microplastics, but there is no sampling method for that. Do you think it is because people are only just becoming aware that there are sources, or is this due to the challenges in terms of sampling these sites?
I assume that the question is about leachate sampling, and I would assume that similar methods to the water methods, water media could be used for leachate. So I would defer to that. There isn't a specific leachate method.
All right, that does it for our first Q&A session. So up next, we are going to look to Dr. Valerie Hanley again for our human health and ecological effects section.
All
All right,
right,
Val. Take
thanks. Thanks, Devin. Okay, and I am just going to apologize in advance that my dog is upset today, and I hope that that will not be, that you all will not be able to hear that. Okay, so today we're going to go over a couple of different things. This section, we're going to talk about both human health and ecological receptors. We're going to talk about exposure to microplastics, what we do know about effects, and a lot about what the uncertainties still are related to the effects of exposure to microplastics. We're also going to talk about some specific tools that we can look at to help us evaluate further the toxicity of microplastics and ecological receptors, and then also how to interpret this data. So it has been a huge increase in microplastic studies over the last decade. This figure was current as of 2021, but it would continue this exponential growth if you look today. This is just showing the yellow is in vivo studies and the orange is our in vitro studies. But you can see that this is a rapidly expanding field. And as we have more and more studies, we are going to gain more information. But this is still a relatively new field of study. And so we are still in a lot of unknowns at this time. So, in terms of human health exposure, we know there are lots of different sources, different media types and pathways, as you've already talked about and going through that interactive case study with Alex. We know that there's the plastics of the microplastics and associated chemicals, as Deechley talked to us about. And then we know that the exposure varies by region and the population, depending on what it is you're consuming. For example, if you're living in an area that has large contamination in your waterways and you're fishing there and you're eating a lot of fish, then you're probably going to consume more microplastics than if you are, in a rural area and not doing that. We do know that inhalation is the number one exposure route for microplastics. A lot of this is in worker safety, but also it is in the atmosphere. And so inhalation generally, and that's followed by a dietary ingestion and then incidental ingestion. And dermal, while there are some effects, it is certainly the least problematic and the lowest exposure for humans. So there are a number of challenges in toxicity research that have led to us not having toxicity criteria yet and still having questions about what those health effects actually are. So we have a lot of non-mammalian human studies, but the usability of the data really varies. Partially, it's because of uncertainties due to study design, how they're reporting the data. Are they reporting based off of size, off of concentration? What is the data quality? Do they have all those proper DQOs? How was the sampling? Did they meet all of these requirements? Like Aaliyah talked to us, this is really a developing field, and so some data is better than others, and we have a lot of data gaps. And so while we know exposure is definitely happening, it is important to note that just because you're exposed to something, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cause an adverse health effect. And so while that question earlier about is it dangerous? You're certainly going to be exposed to microplastics. I would say that the jury is still out on how dangerous that particular thing might be. And so there's just a lot of data. We don't have a good dose response yet, which is so critical in developing toxicity criteria to know, how much you're exposed to and what that potential outcome would be. And so there's been a lot of research done in trying to figure out how to encourage our researchers to get quality data so we can make these toxicity criteria happen and we can better understand the effects. So back in 2021, there was a workshop over a series of days that was hosted by the here in California by the South Coastal. I apologize. It's the S SQRP is their acronym. It's a water purveyor, but they got experts from all over the nation, and they came together and they had a workshop to discuss what was it that they felt was really needed to be reported in a study to feel confident about that data. And so this is their list of criteria that they felt were necessary for it to be considered a high quality study. And so you can see there are about 20 items on this list, maybe a little bit more, 26, sorry, criteria that are listed. And so the red ones were considered minimum requirement. Those were absolutely needed in order to evaluate the data that was generated. And then the green are desired. And so you can see here that a lot of the studies did not actually meet, this dose response. Again, that's critical for toxicity data to have a dose response. And effect thresholds. These are two things that were considered minimally required and were only found in about 50% of the studies. And so, this is one of the reasons why when we're increasing our publication rates and we have more data that's coming out, we still have a lot of unknowns. So through that, they evaluated the studies that were available and they ranked what they felt were the most reliable human health toxicity endpoints from those studies. Now you'll notice here on the x-axis, the number of studies reporting this effect. This only goes up to four for the highest one, which was sperm deformity. So again, this is based off of a really limited number of sample studies that they could look at, but this is what they found to be the most reliable. And they mainly have to do with male reproduction, and there's also some related to female reproduction and some of the liver, and then there are some effects on body weight. And I do sincerely apologize that my dog is very upset and being very loud. I hope you all are not hearing her too much. I apologize. So moving into studies based off of ecological groups, we have a lot more data in terms of non-humans, right? So a lot of this data is in the fish. That's where we have most of the data, but also a lot of from crustaceans. And again, this is looking at on the y-axis, we're looking at the number of endpoints measured. And then on the x-axis, we have what species it was that was actually explored. All of this data comes from a really great app that I'm going to talk to you about in just a moment. But this is where that data is compiled. So again, we have more studies here than we do on human health, but still a lot to learn. What we do know and what we've been able to see with aquatic toxicity is that particle size absolutely matters. So the smaller the particle size, we see things more associated with cellular damage, like inflammation and reactive oxygen generation, and that is surface area dependent. And as the particle size gets larger, we're looking more at physical damage, things such as food dilution, gastrointestinal obstruction, and then irritation and injury. So again, looking at these influencing factors, for those size range, like we said, size matters. It's really the particles that were less than 83 micrometers were shown to have the ability to translocate across the cell membrane. And so those were more likely to have those cellular impacts. Fibers are a very commonly found microplastic in the environment. However, it's very understudied in terms of tissue translocation. So again, these are some of the confounding factors that make it difficult for us in interpreting all of the data that is out there. Now, for those larger particle sizes, again, we're looking mainly at nutritional deficiencies. Microplastics can be mistaken as food. As Dietschle mentioned in the introduction, certain colors especially can make them more interesting. This can lead to nutritional deficiencies due to food dilution. And, we can also see damage due to the different shapes and surfaces of the microplastics can cause more physical damage to the animals as well. So this is that app that I mentioned, the Toxicity of Microplastics Explorer Application, or TOMEX. This is an application that was put together. It also came out of that workshop that I mentioned previously. And what this is an open source database that takes data from many different studies, and it has both a human health and an ecological risk side to it. And it allows you to go in and look at the data that's been generated by other researchers, have some good data analysis and visualization. That's where we had that figure that showed earlier with the different ecological receptors and what their whether they had effects or no effects seen in those studies. And it can really help to guide risk assessment and future research. Again, the ecological side is more robust because there's more studies there than the human health side, but they just did a revamp of this last year and added additional studies. And so this is something that they are updating frequently to keep it as up to date as possible so that we can have a really good way for researchers to collaborate, to come up with ways to set different thresholds. For example, is one of the ways that it can be used. And this is, in fact, how it was used in this study here from Mahinto et al. They went through and looked in that data, and they came up with five tiers of concern with four different thresholds. So a threshold was starting from blue, saying no action is required, there's no concern there, all the way up to red, being this is the highest concern, and we need to implement pollution controls. And what they did then is they took those thresholds that were designed there and they applied it to some real life sampling data. This is from the San Francisco Bay here in California. And the key takeaway is that we saw all of these different tiers were represented in these areas. You could see that we had more of the highest concern in the inland areas and near real populated areas. And then the further you got out, then you were more into that low concern. But this is one way that that tool could be used to set risk thresholds and apply to real life data. Okay, so we also have a case study looking at microplastics on the endpoints of ecological endpoints in the Chesapeake Bay. As Alex mentioned in our interactive case study, bays are a large place where we really look at because we have a lot of population and lots of ecology there. And so the Chesapeake Bay is very well studied in terms of microplastics. And so if you can look at our case study to learn a little bit more about the consequences of microplastics in the Chesapeake Bay. And so finally, I want to summarize that we know that microplastics cause physical, chemical, and biological hazards. Exposure characterization is uncertain, but we certainly know we are all exposed. Microplastics have been found in the human lung, in blood, in meconium, in the placenta, in breast milk. We know that microplastics are entering our bodies. We know there is exposure even from in utero in babies and early in birth. So exposure is absolutely happening. We need to continue these studies and continue to align our data so that we can come up with toxicity criteria, and that will allow us to set more standards as we move forward. Because again, we don't know what those adverse outcomes are yet for humans. We're still exploring that. But we know that exposure is in fact there. And we know from, especially from ecological, but it also I think translates very well into the humans, that particle size and shape do influence toxicity. But ultimately, there is still a lot more to learn. We do have a very detailed section in our technical guidance document with lots and lots of references. So I do absolutely recommend, if you want to know more, to go into that document and read more and go to the primary literature to get additional information. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Alex to take on our interactive case study.
Thanks, Valerie. So this is the last time you get to listen to me. We've gone through what were the sources, what were the media being exposed to from those plastics from those sources, and how it moved through the environment by how was it transported. So the last one we're going to who are the receptors, both human and ecological. So looking at this figure here, and from what we've heard from the various speakers so far, you should be able to answer these questions. These two questions very easily. So use the chat function like we did before. Do not use the question and answer pod. Make sure you use the chat function. So we have 30 seconds. Commence doing it now. So we have fish and humans, birds, all living beings, aquatic animals, waterfowl, filter feeders, birds, farm animals. Factory workers, very good. Somebody got the factory workers. That's like one 10 people tend to miss. Plant, wild, agricultural people, invertebrates, livestock and feed crops. Got 2 more seconds. Very good. Good job, guys. Good job. So here, let's check, see what our answers are. Not going. Okay. So here are the possible answers. So first we'll go. Human receptors are on the left-hand side, ecological receptors on the right-hand side. So we had the beach user, people, the people out in the environment just doing their thing, being humans. The bay swimmer, the guy swimming in the bay, he's being exposed by, he's probably swallowing some of that water, he's breathing air in. The agricultural workers, factory workers, we had those answers had come in. Urban residents, of course, urban people are going to be exposed not only just from that environment around them, but actually within their building themselves. Local anglers, catching the fish, produce and crop consumers. So aquatic, yeah, ecological sectors. I think you got almost all of these. Soil, one we might miss was soil invertebrates. I'm not thinking like the worms in the fat in the soil. They're being exposed. That's probably one we usually don't tend to think of, but critters in the soils can be exposed to plastics too. So that's basically everything out there. Any creatures out there are being exposed. So think, take that in mind when you're going to be going through and figuring out, okay, what questions am I going to try and answer in my particular project? So if you look at, you're going to take all the information you just did. We've showed you where, where the sources are, how they're moving through the environment, what media they use, and who's being exposed. So that now that gives you can have enough information to set up your conceptual site model. So I don't know what your study is going to be. Is it going to be on impacts in the fish in the bay? Is it going to be impacts on biosolids and crop uptake? Whatever it's going to be, you have enough information now to at least develop your conceptual site model. And then developing a sampling analysis plan is this is not any different than another chemical. So you're going to be doing the same process, developing a sampling analysis plan to answer your data quality objectives that from and looking at your conceptual site model. The only thing different about this is just like PFAS is there are some sampling analysis things you need to consider by plastics and actually collecting those samples and analyzing those samples to make sure you get results that are useful. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nizana from US EPA. There were a couple of questions in the last question and answer period asking about are there regulations out there? And so she's going to be discussing that for you.
Thanks, Alex. So I'm just going to provide a very high-level overview of the regulatory context for Okay. In 2021, ITRC surveyed states about their actions that they were considering taking or actually taking to address microplastics. I'm sorry, let me just go back one slide. It's too quick here. And so this slide includes some of the sort of most significant results that we received. So results were received from about 25 states. So if you want to delve a little bit more deeply into the results from the survey, we definitely suggest that you take a look at section 5.1 of the guidance document. So just turning quickly to just what this slide, is depicting here. So we found that, California, Texas, and New Jersey have reported sampling for microplastics. We did find that no states had regulatory criteria, and that includes water quality standards. So no states reported having those. But two states, California and Pennsylvania, are looking into the possibility of establishing criteria. And six states reported that at some point in the future, they may be looking into developing criteria as well. So states have taken kind of a range of regulatory actions to tackle plastic pollution. And so the focus of this slide here is on what some states have done to address macroplastics. So the most typical kinds of actions taken by states have included recycling mandates, phasing out single-use plastic bags, phasing out restaurant utensils, and food packaging. So that's primarily carry-out packaging. Some states have actually banned the implementation of these kinds of requirements by local governments. So just wanted to make sure that you were aware that some states have actually prevented local governments from taking these kinds of actions. So you can find more information about state actions to address macroplastics in Appendix C of the guidance document. And what I'm going to do next is walk through this appendix in the next few slides, since it also includes actions to address microplastics. So Appendix C in the online guidance document is in the form of an Excel spreadsheet with a tab for state, federal, and international statutes and regulations. So the federal tab includes statutes like the Clean Water Act and the Marine Debris Act. It also includes bills that were passed by Congress that authorize plastic pollution reduction efforts. You know, one example of this that you might have heard of is 2021 Save Our Seas 2.0. So there are two other tabs in that Excel spreadsheet in Appendix C. So tab one lists the acronyms and abbreviations. And the other tab, which I kind of just touched on, focuses on state macroplastics actions. So I'm just going to walk quickly through what Appendix C kind of captures here. So let's take a look at the state regulatory context table. So what can be found here is a summary table that lists all of the states and highlights whether or not they have requirements in place that are focused on plastics and microplastics. So each of these requirements are described briefly, and web links to access additional information are included where available. So one example of what the summary table includes is Connecticut's 2021 House Bill number 5360, which established a working group of representatives from both the retail and apparel industries and the environmental community. And what this working group focuses on is synthetic microfiber pollution. And they help to develop consumer awareness and educational programs. So that's their focus. Another example of what this table includes is Illinois' prohibition of manufacturing and sale of any non-drug personal care products that contain synthetic plastic microbeads by 2018 and 2019, respectively. So this law also prohibits the manufacture for sale and the sale of any over-the-counter drug that contains synthetic plastic microbeads by 2019 and 2020. So the International Regulatory Context tab is also a summary table of some statutes and regulations from around the world. And and those actions are centered on addressing plastic and microplastics. So again, web links are included so that additional information can be accessed. So this slide provides a timeline for one example of an international regulatory action. And this action was taken by the European Union. The European Union requested that the European Chemicals Agency, and this is the agency that's charged with implementing the EU's chemical legislation and policy. So they asked this agency to work on limiting the intentional addition of microplastics to consumer and professional products. So in 2019, the European Chemicals Agency was able to develop that, and they proposed this policy. And later on in 2020, the Committee for Risk Assessment then supported this proposal. And then they also included a recommendation to remove the lower limit on size that was included in that proposal. So the proposal included a requirement that would limit the size to 100 nanometers. And they decided to remove that requirement because they just determined that it was not needed for enforcement. So the next stage of this was that the REACH committee voted in favor of the proposal, and ultimately the proposal was adopted. So in September 20, on September 24th to 2023. So another example of actions that are included in this international regulatory context is provided by the United Nations work to develop a plastics treaty. So what this slide includes is some of the key language from the United Nations Environmental Programs report, Turning Off the Tap, which is available online. And this report was developed in support of this plastics treaty effort. And as you can see, it's a pretty broad goal here. And the UN is continuing to work towards finalizing this treaty. And I believe the target date for that is actually this year. So now I'm just going to walk through the main aspects of a case study from the online guidance document. So this case study focuses on California's approach to addressing microplastics, and it's just intended to provide a closer look at the key components of one state's microplastics program. So in 2018, the state passed a pair of bills, Senate Bill 1422 and Senate Bill 1263. 1422 focused on drinking water and included a definition of microplastics and a standard method applicable to testing for microplastics in drinking water. It also included a four-year drinking water testing and reporting requirement, which included public disclosure of the results. So a policy handbook was also issued in September of 22 to help with implementing this four-year testing effort. So the first 2 years of monitoring results will be made publicly available, followed by 6 months of evaluation. And that evaluation process will include figuring out whether or not more sophisticated test methods are needed. So Senate Bill 1263 committed the state to developing and implementing statewide microplastic strategy. This strategy was issued in February 2022 and is available online. And what is done in this strategy is that it provides a multi-year roadmap identifying specific actions that the state plans to take. So that is the end of my very quick overview. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Yasmin to cover mitigation and abatement.
Okay, thank you, Nizan. So right now we are at the final chapter of the guidance documents and still interesting stuff available. I will now be covering mitigation and abatement, which can be found in Section 6 of our guidance document. During the first half of this presentation, we will focus on prevention and mitigation strategies and best management practices to reduce microplastics from entering the environment. The second half, we will focus on technologies to abate, treat, and remediate microplastics once it exists in the environment, whether in drinking water, surface water, groundwater, marine environments, wastewater, soil, sediment, and air. Let's see. Okay. There is a problem with my stuff that let's try again. I think it go further too much. Yeah, there you go. Sorry about that. In order to keep as much material out of the landfill as possible, it is important for each of us to do our part. One of the ways to put this plan into action is to apply a waste management hierarchy as guidance for managing plastics. The United States Environmental Protection, EPA, created a waste management hierarchy that categorizes the steps necessary to manage in a method that benefits people and reduces the impact on the environment. As you can see on this figure, the most preferred method of the waste management is source reduction and reuse that follows recycling, composting, energy recovery, and the least preferred method of the waste management is treatment and disposal. So, next slide. In the guidance document, mitigation and prevention strategies actually were organized in four general topic areas. You can just see the two topic areas. And for the following slide, I'm going to continue with the remaining two strategy. The first one is reducing plastic packaging and increasing plastic reuse. This is under Section 611, manufacturing and packaging. The second one is improving production efficiency under Section 612, including life cycle assessment and alternative analysis of plastic product and material substitutions to prevent regrettable solutions. These are important strategies to improve plastic sustainability throughout the life cycle. So we talk about the life cycle assessment, how we can use this one as a tool. Life cycle assessment is a tool used to assess the environmental impact of a product or process from beginning to end and identify strategic improvement opportunities such as sustainable solutions to avoid regrettable substitutions, social and supply chain impacts. The use of plastics can be reduced by using alternatives such as glass, recycled, or non-plastic biodegradable materials, improving the design to reduce the amount of plastic use, extend product life, allow repair and reuse, and improve recyclability by limiting the number of polymers, additives, and mixtures. And the last one is banning certain types of single-use plastics. As you can see on the screen, this figure shows the life cycle assessment stages of the distribute recycling via additive related to use of recycled materials by means of mechanical recycling process in the 3D printing process chain. Considering the different specificity of additive manufacturing processes, a broad field opportunities emerges to develop more sustainable means of production at different levels of chain values. This shift goes from design and manufacturing optimization until the synthesis of advanced materials into the final product. The worldwide microplastic contamination issues can only be controlled by incorporating responsible and sustainable practices into the production, use, and waste disposition of different plastic materials. I just did go over the first two parameters. The third one is the reduced consumption of plastic via product substitution. This concept can be found in Section 613 of the guidance documents. So also education and awareness, another important criteria for the prevention strategies. The last one is Can be found in section 614 of guidance documents under improving disposal waste. Significant improvements to waste disposal can only be achieved through global initiatives that involve education and waste minimization practices, expanded collection surfaces for reuse, recycling and disposal, reduce production of non-reusable and non-recyclable materials, and further improvements to recycling processes. North American and European countries typically have organized public or private waste collection services, but when we look at the large part of the world's population, unfortunately, they don't have access to an organized collection waste for disposal at properly designated landfills, and even less for recycling, for which options are often not affordable or not available. There are several options, as you can see on the screen as a list for managing the plastic waste. One of them is source collection and post-separation disposal, reuse or regrouping, waste to energy and feedstock, landfilling, bio-based and biodegradable plastic alternatives, electronic waste recycling, enhancing distribution, storage, transportation, and the last one is storm water control. Related to bio-based and biodegradable plastics, I would like to point that being bio-based does not make it any more biodegradable or any less likely to create microplastics. These products are recyclable through the normal recycling pathways. So this wrap up the first part of my presentation regarding prevention and mitigation. Before we move into discussing remediation technologies, I would like everyone to use the chat function to comment one thing that can be done to reduce microplastics from entering in the environment. Perfect. Yeah, I can see a lot of different options to reduce microplastics entering the environment. Here is another potential action. Actually, I saw on the responses, you could take that one of the, this is actually covered in one of our case studies, the installation of washing machine filters. You can see on the next slide, sorry. These filters significantly reduce the number of microfibers reaching the wastewater treatment plants in a community in Ontario. If you would like to read more about it, you can refer to the Appendix A6 in the guidance document. Let's talk about the abatement strategies. The treatment technologies described in section 621 through section 624 are organized by media based on the degree of development and implementation, as well as confidence in the technology based on peer review literature and professional judgment of the authors. Two levels of implementation confidence are defined as follows. When we decide to list those treatment technologies, we just focus on the two different technologies based on the first one is field implemented technologies. Technologies that have been demonstrated under full-scale conditions at multiple sites by multiple practitioners and multiple applications and are well documented in practice or peer-reviewed literature. For example, wastewater treatment plants, drinking water treatment plants, some of the examples for the field implemented technologies. The second one is developing technologies, technologies that have not been field demonstrated. They were not implemented at the field yet. Often these results reported by only one group, like one university practitioner or vendor, or lack detailed validation of the treatment effectiveness or mechanisms. For example, acoustic focusing, electrochemical oxidation, magnetic extraction are some of examples for developing technologies. So this is a figure 6.5 from the ITRC guidance document. Actually, this is kind of, if you are familiar with the wastewater treatment plants, it is an example of from the wastewater treatment plants showing a conceptual estimation of microplastic removal and retention in different stages of wastewater treatment plants. When we look at the figure, you can see that the different stages include preliminary and primary treatment, such as, you know, grit chamber, grease removal, primary settling tank, secondary treatment such as activated sludge reactors, bioreactors, secondary clarifiers, and the tertiary treatment like rapid sand filtration, membrane disk filter, coagulation, flagellation. As you can see on the figure, removal efficiencies in the individual treatment stages, when you look at the preliminary treatment, for example, you have only 30 to 60% microplastic removal. When we look at all over the this process at the wastewater treatment plant, individual treatment stages range from 2 to 75%. However, when we combine with the, you know, tertiary treatment, you can see that when you add the tertiary treatment, it is removal efficiency 94 to 99%. At the end of the secondary treatment, we can see that 75 to 95% micro plastic removal achieved. This is just one of the example for the treatment technologies, how microplastic can be removed. The next slide is just, I do not expect to read this table. It is just to show that we have this table in the guidance document, and I'm just going to give brief information about this table. The first one is table 6.3. This table provides a summary of potential treatment technologies for removing microplastic from drinking water, surface water, groundwater, marine and wastewater. This table only focusing on the water. And table 6.4 provides a potential treatment technologies for soil. Maybe you're gonna ask, do we have a table for air? Unfortunately, it is not available because there are very, very few studies conducted on the focusing on the air for microplastics. And also, as I mentioned earlier, I just want to bring to your attention that this table 6.3 is really a huge table. You are seeing only a small portion of this table. It is, I think, almost 24 different treatment technologies that we presented on this table. So when we just I want to show how you can use this table. When you look at the row on the left with this circle, you can see the treatment technology, if it is biological, chemical, or physical. And also on the top row, you can see each row treatment technology, media, if it is, surface water, groundwater, or wastewater, advantages and efficiencies of each technologies summarized. And also at the end of the column, you can see the preferences. And also there are another option that you can look for. The first one, developing technology or lab scale, or the another one is general technology. If you want to just focus on the laboratory scale, you need to focus on this area on the table. And also when you look at these removals on the advantages and efficiencies column, these are based on the laboratory studies, most of them, I would say, because it is really limited information for the field scale implementation and removal of the microplastics from the field scale implementation. So we are coming to end of my presentation, but I would like to summarize first what we learned about this section very, very quickly. Source reduction, of course, very important to reduce microplastics in the environment. And in order to minimize the negative impacts derived from plastic pollution, different strategies would have to be considered simultaneously, and not only a reduction in the use of plastics and their replacement by other alternatives such as cardboard or biodegradable polymers, but also eco-design, environmental education, improvements in waste management, and others. Based on the literature review, including the studies that we did go over today, it is obvious that existing treatment technologies have been showing different success to reduce microplastics. And it is also very important to consider management of waste produced during the treatment of microplastics. Yeah, this is the end of my presentation. With that, I turn over to Todd Miller for wrap-up slides. Thank you.
Thank you, Yasmin. Before we get to the last Q&A session of the day, I'm going to give a brief wrap-up of what we covered today. So let's see. There we are. Just a brief reminder that the guidance document is a web-based guidance document, and it can be found on the ITRC website at the URL provided here on this slide. So in the introduction section, we presented definitions for microplastics and why we should care about them. They're ubiquitous and persistent in the environment. They contain harmful chemicals, and they are consumed by animals and humans, resulting in potential health effects and environmental impacts. In the fate and transport section, we described primary and secondary sources, how microplastics are released into the environment, how they're transported and where they end up, and various degradation pathways. In the sampling and analysis portion of this, we describe the state of the science for sampling and analyzing microplastics, as well as concerns that can impact the results. During the human health and the ecological effects portion, we describe pathways for human and ecological exposure, the challenges of reviewing and comparing microplastic study results, how particle size and chemical makeup play key roles in their effects, and briefly presented tools available for evaluating health risks. In the current regulation section, we presented the key results of the ITRC group's poll of 25 states, which showed that at the time of the study, only three states had sampled for microplastics, and those states had regulatory criteria, though several were considering some form. And during the mitigation and abatement portion, we discussed best management practices and focused on keeping plastics out of the environment by reducing use and developing alternative products, educating the public on alternatives, and improving recycling. As a reminder, throughout the document, you will see the CSM figure here on this slide. In the introduction section, clicking on each of the dots will bring up a short description of how microplastics are found in the environment. And in subsequent sections, these dots will link you to associated sections of the text. Section 7 of the document describes data gaps regarding microplastic knowledge or information. For freight and transport, the fact that microplastics are found in nearly everywhere we look, but the transport mechanisms are only partially understood. For sampling analysis, there's a need for better reference standards, better analytical techniques and instruments, and lower costs. And health risks, impacts to human health and the environment are not very well understood. And additionally, how changes to the physical and chemical structure of microplastics can impact our ability to fully assess their risks. For trophic transfer, there's a large need to better understand the impacts that size and shape have on how microplastics move throughout the food web. And for mitigation and abatement, the need for replacement products as well as better practices to control and remove microplastics from the environment. Now, there are six case studies we featured in Appendix A of the microplastics guidance document. Case study number one is California Approach for Microplastics, which describes the legislation and other activities the state of California is taking related to microplastics. Case study two is consequences of microplastics on various ecological endpoints in the Chesapeake Bay and its tributary estuary, the Potomac River. This case study discusses the effects of microplastics on three organisms found in the Chesapeake Bay: the hooked mussel, the blue crab, and the striped bass. Case study three is the impact of disposable PPE and single-use plastic items during the COVID-19 pandemic, which explores the effects of these increases in single-use plastics related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Case study four is nurdles along the Gulf Coast, which describes a notable spill of plastic nurdles into the Mississippi River. Case study five is the effects of 6 PPD quinone on coho and chum salmon. This case study presents an evaluation of tire wear particles' impacts on acute mortality in coho and chum salmon and details mitigation efforts to decrease the transport of tire wear particles to surface waters. Case study six is washing machine filters reduce microfiber emissions to aquatic ecosystems, which describes a policy brief prepared for Toronto, Canada. We hope you can take time to review these case studies to gain more information. We'd also like to bring your attention to an ITRC team that started in February 2023, referred to as the Microplastics Outreach Toolkit Team. The team is utilizing the information contained in the existing ITRC microplastics document to create outreach toolkits that contain products such as downloadable fact sheets and social media campaigns to provide clear communication to the public about the extent of the problem presented by microplastics, how people and our environment are being affected by microplastics, and what citizens can do to help reduce microplastics. It's our hope that the Microplastic Outreach Toolkit will provide valuable resources for environmental professionals to engage with and educate clients, regulators, in the public about microplastics. This slide just shows a couple of examples of some of the draft fact sheets that the Outreach Toolkit team is putting together. And now I'll turn it back over to Devin from ITRC to facilitate a Q&A portion of our training.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Todd, and all of our trainers for presenting those wonderful modules. At this time, we are going to jump right back into our Q&A. So I will look to the Q&A pod and read out some questions for our trainers to answer live. And then we'll wrap up with some logistical information for all of our attendees. All right. So our first question here for our trainers, what is on the horizon for solid waste disposal facilities and how to protect the surrounding communities from the end of life of MPs?
Devin, I wish I had a crystal ball for that. I don't think there's an answer for that right now. Again, microplastics is a relatively new field of study, if you will, compared to a lot of other things that we're looking at in the environmental field. So I don't think we really have a good answer for that, but that's a great question and I appreciate someone asking.
All right. Thank you, Todd. All right. Our next question. Is there any treatment to remove microplastics from the sludge in wastewater treatment plants? The issue is that the sludge can be used to create biosolids, which is then land applied.
I just want to know that it's a great question. I think we've got so many good questions that are coming in that are all the ongoing research that needs to be done to advance this field. I personally, and any of my co-trainers can certainly jump in if they know of something. I don't know of any specific treatments for biosludge. I don't think that we have any in our guidance document that are listed. But you're absolutely correct that that is a major issue, that microplastics end up in biosludge and then they can be land applied. And we do know that plants can uptake microplastics. We've found microplastics in tomatoes, for example. So agree with you that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, but I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, Valerie, I would agree. I haven't seen any studies on soil treatment, and I'll lump the biosolids into soil treatment for removing microplastics. There may be some out there. There may be some people looking at it. I'll also remind folks that, you know, even if we were to apply the biosludge or not apply the biosludge to land farming or, you know, land, sorry, to land for, say, farming purposes, which is usually what happens with biosludge, there's still a lot of microplastics used in the agricultural industry. And that's, you know, going to present the same type of problem. So just be aware that removing it from or not using the biosludge on farms isn't going to necessarily take away that risk of microplastics. But it's a great question. Thank you.
And also keep in mind that biosolids are also under suspicion due to PFAS contamination. So not only is microplastics, that PFAS is rearing its ugly head in using biosolids for food growing of crops. So
yep,
it'll be interesting to see how they address both these things.
Related to the PFAS in biosolids, EPA is currently doing a study of PFAS in biosolids, and I can put the link in the chat.
All right, thank you, trainers. Some great conversation there. We do have a question asking about referring to the section of our guidance document about data gaps and future research needs. In our trainers' opinions, what is the most crucial one that needs to be addressed?
Oh. Wow. From
I
my
think
perspective,
we all just laughed to ourselves.
Yeah.
from my perspective, and I've had a lot of conversations about this recently. And Valerie, this goes back to your area of expertise, which is, I think, human health studies. You know, we know it's a problem in the environment. We know, you know, litter is a problem in the environment. It's an eyesore, but it's also a problem for the food web in itself. But ultimately, I think a critical study is how is it affecting our health? You know, where is this going to end up? As Valerie pointed out, exposure doesn't necessarily equal effect or impact, but there's got to be something going on. So that would be my vote for critical. I mean, we're going to spend years and years studying fate and transport and settlement and, you know, can you remediate it out of soils and sediments and biosolids? There's all kinds of studies that will occur over the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever it takes. But I think the health effects, both from a biological and a human health, it would be my vote, Valerie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm as a toxicologist, I certainly agree with you on that. I also think we need to be taking a precautionary approach. I don't think we need to know what the effects are before we can take actions. So while I absolutely agree with you, we need to know what those effects are. Everyone wants to know, is it dangerous? And I don't think that we can truly answer that yet, although I think we all know we don't like that microplastics are part of our bodies. We don't like that our children are being born with microplastics already in their meconium. I mean, that nobody likes the sound of that. So we certainly need to do a lot to just reduce. And then also, I think remediation technologies in terms of how to clean it up, because we're, you know, we need to stop producing them. And then we need to learn how to get them out of the environment. But I agree. I really would love to know what those health effects are, because I think that's one of the ways you get people to care. If I can tell you what that's doing to your body, if I can tell you what is happening to your child, then maybe you, you know, would be more likely to take the necessary steps to reduce your impact in producing microplastics.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So with that, we are going to end our Q&A section, and I am going to wrap up with just some logistics for all of our attendees. I did put the link to the PFAS study in the chat for everybody, as well as ahead of that, the link to the Kluin Microplastics training page, which is where you're going to find any of the trainer information, the slides that we use today, and then also the feedback form that will generate a certificate of completion for you for today's webinar. If you have any additional questions or would like any clarification on any questions or answers provided today, feel free to reach out to us at ITRC at itrcweb.org. You're also encouraged and welcome to reach out to our trainers directly. Their information is on the Kluin Microplastics training page. If you reach out to ITRC, we will coordinate a response with the appropriate trainer. Apart from all that logistics, I'd like to just extend a thank you to our attendees for joining us today. And a big thank you to our expert trainers for not only helping to contribute and develop this training course, but to be here today and give us all those great responses and training presentations. So with that, I will wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day. And I will be doing some logistical background here, but that is the wrap of our microplastics webinar here. Thank you very much.